place. The harvest brought a level of normalcy to the land and to a people living under the dark clouds of war. Everyone knew a soldier who was either waiting to be shipped off or already fighting. Pete Banning was the first casualty from Ford County, but then other boys were killed or wounded or missing. 4 months into widowhood, Liza managed to establish some semblance of a routine. Once the kids were off to school, she had coffee with Nineveh, who slowly became her sounding board and her strength. Liza puttered in the garden with Amos and Jupe, met each morning with Buford to discuss the crops, and tried to stay away from town. She quickly grew tired of the endless inquiries about how she was doing, how she was holding up, how the kids were handling it all. If spotted in town, she was forced to endure hugs and tears from people she hardly knew. For the sake of her children, she forced the family to go to church, but the three of them grew to dislike the Sunday ritual. They began skipping occasionally to avoid the constant condolences and instead walked to Florrie's cottage for brunches on the patio. No one condemned them for their chapel cuts. Most weekday mornings, Dexter Bell drove out to visit Liza. They had coffee, a devotional, and a prayer. They sat in Pete's study with the door closed and talked in soft voices. Nineveh, as always, hovered nearby. Pete had been gone for almost a year, and Liza knew he was not coming home. If he were alive, he would find a way to send a letter or a message. And as the days and weeks passed without a word, she accepted the unspeakable reality. She admitted this to no one, but gamely went about her dark days as if she held out hope. It was important for Joel and Stella, and for Nineveh and Amos, and everyone else. But in private, she wept and sat for hours in her dark bedroom. Joel was 16, a senior in high school, and was talking of enlisting. He would soon turn 17, and upon graduation could join the army, if his mother agreed. She said she would not, and such talk upset her. She had lost her husband and was not about to lose her son. Stella fought with Joel to quell such nonsense, and he reluctantly stopped talking about fighting. His future was in college. In early October, the rain stopped and the skies cleared. The soggy terrain bred a fresh wave of mosquitoes, and malaria hit the guerrillas hard. Virtually every man had it to some degree, many for the third or fourth time, and living with it became normal. They carried bottles of quinine and cared for their sicker comrades. With the roads passable, the Japanese convoys became more frequent, but the guerrillas were often too weak to strike. Pete had gained a few pounds, though he guessed he was still 50 pounds below his fighting weight, when fevers and chills knocked him down for a week. During a lull, when he was wrapped in a blanket and semi-lucid, he realized it was October 4th, 1 year to the day after he left home. Without a doubt, it had been the most memorable year of his life. He was sleeping when a runner woke him with orders to report to Lord Granger. He and Clay staggered from their hut and reported to the general's post. Intelligence had reported a large convoy of oil tankers leaving a port and headed inland. Within an hour, G Troop was moving down the mountain in the darkness. It bivouacked with Dubose's D Troop, and 40 guerrillas were on the move, most of them weakened with malaria, but excited to have a mission. The rains and mosquitoes had not stopped the war. Engineers from the Imperial Army had carved a new supply road, one that Granger had heard rumors of. Dubose found it first, and he and Pete hiked it with their men in search of an ambush point. Finding none, they began to backtrack when 4-0s suddenly appeared at treetop level. Majors Banning and Dubose ordered their men to retreat to a hillside and buried themselves in the bush to wait. A recon unit soon appeared, two platoons of Japanese soldiers on foot. They carried machetes and hacked their way through the bush beside the road, looking for guerrillas. It was a new tactic, one that clearly showed the importance of the convoy. Trucks could soon be heard, and lots of them. The first three were open carriers packed with soldiers at the ready. Behind them were six tankers loaded to the brim with gasoline and diesel fuel. Their rear was protected by three more carriers. The plan was to attack with hand grenades and ignite a massive fireball, but the guerrillas were not close enough. The target was tempting, but Major Banning wisely backed off. He signaled Dubose 100 yards away. Dubose agreed, and the guerrillas withdrew even deeper. The convoy inched along and was soon out of sight. The hike back to base was dispiriting. The clear skies brought not only waves of mosquitoes, but waves of Zeros and scout planes as well. Granger feared the Japanese knew his location and were closing in, though he still maintained that a ground assault was unlikely. The enemy had shown little interest in a prolonged fight up the mountain into forbidding territory. What worried Granger, though, was a threat from the air. A few well-aimed bombs could do immeasurable damage. He met daily with his commanders and discussed moving the base, but they were not in favor of it. They were heavily camouflaged. Their supplies and armaments were untouchable in the caves. Moving the base would create too much activity that might be noticed from the air. They were at home and felt as though they could defend anything. An informant had passed along the news that the Japanese were offering a bounty of $50,000 on the head of Lord Granger. But typically, he took it as an honor. Rewards of up to $5,000 were offered for the capture of any American officer involved with the resistance. One afternoon, over a game of cribbage and a cup of tea, Granger handed Pete a small green metal box, about the size of a brick, but much lighter. At one end, there was a dial and a switch. Granger explained, called a Luse bomb, a new toy from a bomb maker in Manila. Inside is a pound of plastic explosive, a quarter pound of thermite, a bit of diesel fuel, and a detonator. The backside is magnetized. Stick it to the side of an aeroplane, near the fuel tank, turn the dial, flip the switch, run like hell, and a few minutes later, enjoy the fireworks. Pete admired it and set it on the table. Brilliant. Cooked by a British commando named Jock Lewes in North Africa. Our boys there wiped out entire fleets of Italian and German planes. Bloody good idea, if you ask me. And so? And so, the Nips have 100 Zeros at Fort Stotzenberg. The bloody buggers that are tormenting us. I'm thinking about a raid. You know the place well, I take it.
Very well. It was the home of the 26th Cavalry. I spent time there before the hostilities.
Can it be done, Major? Nips would never see it coming. Dangerous as hell, though.
Is this an order?
Not yet. Think about it. You and Dubose, 40 men, 40 more from a base operating above Stotzenberg. The Luse bombs can be delivered from Manila to a post near the fort. From here, it's a 3-day hike, grueling. I'm thinking that you go prepared for the raid and have a look. Security is tight. Nips on the ground everywhere. If it's impossible, back away and don't get hurt.
I like it, Pete said, still admiring the Luse bomb.
We've got maps, the layout and all. Plenty of intelligence on the ground. You'll be in command. It's all yours. And you probably won't come back.
When do we leave?
Are you strong enough? What with the shivers and all?
We've all got the fevers, but I'm recovering.
Are you sure? It's not an order, and you can say no. As you know, I don't order suicide missions.
We'll be back. I promise. Plus, I'm bored.
Jolly good, Major. Jolly good.
They left at dark, with DuBose and D Troop half an hour behind. They hiked for 10 hours and stopped at dawn above a village. They rested throughout the day and noticed several Japanese patrols moving through the area. At dark, they moved on. The mountains turned to hills and vegetation thinned. At dawn of the third day, they topped a rise and Fort Stotzenberg was before them, about a mile away, in the center of a sweeping plain. From his position, Pete took in the vastness of his old fort. Before the war, it had housed not only the 26th Cavalry Regiment, but also 4 artillery regiments, 2 American and 2 Filipino, along with the 12th Quartermaster Regiment. The rows of barracks housed 8,000 soldiers. The stately gate posts at the front entrance were visible. Between 2 long runways were dozens of buildings once used by good guys and now bustling with the enemy. Behind them were the wide parade grounds where Pete had played polo, but the moment did not allow nostalgia. Parked in neat rows along the runways were more Zeros than he could count, along with 20 or so 2-seated fighters the Allies called Nicks. There was no wall around the fort, no fencing or barbed wire barriers, just thousands of Japs going about their business. Troops drilled on the parade grounds, while Zeros took off and landed. The runners led them to an advance post, where they met a squad led by Captain Miller, a baby-faced enlisted man from Minnesota. His squad had 10 men, all Filipinos, and they knew the area well. Miller was waiting on another squad that was supposed to have arrived the day before. At the post, the men huddled over maps and waited. At midnight, when the fort was quiet, Pete, DuBose, and Miller crept closer to it and spent the rest of the night circling the area. They returned at dawn, exhausted, but with a plan. The shipment of Luz bombs did not arrive as scheduled, and they waited 2 days for word from Manila. They also waited on the other guerrillas Granger had promised, but they did not materialize. Pete worried that they had been captured and the entire mission had been compromised. In all, he had 55 men available for some mischief. By the third day at the post, food was running low, and the men were becoming irritable. Major Banning scolded them and maintained discipline. The Luz bombs finally arrived on the backs of 3 mules led by teenage boys, skinny kids who would hardly raise suspicions. Again, Pete marveled at Granger's network. The fort was outside Angeles City, a sprawling town of 100,000, with plenty of bars and brothels to keep the Japanese officers entertained. The raid began at 1 in the morning with a carjacking when 2 drunken captains staggered out of a nightclub and headed to their sedan for the ride back to the fort. 3 Filipino guerrillas posing as local peasants slit their throats in an alley, stripped off their uniforms, and changed clothes. They fired 3 shots as a signal, then 10 minutes later drove the car past the sentries at the front gate of Fort Stotzenberg. Once inside, they parked the car in front of the commander's residence and disappeared into the darkness. 3 Luz bombs were stuck to the car's undercarriage, and the explosion disrupted the peaceful night. Guerrillas hiding behind the gymnasium began firing into the air, and the guards panicked. The airplanes were watched closely at night by sentries. At the sound of the explosion and wild gunfire, they broke ranks and began running in the direction of the commotion. Major Banning swept in from the north, DuBose from the east, Miller from the west. They gunned down every sentry in sight, then quickly began sticking the Luz bombs to the underside of 80 of the hated Zeros. In the darkness, the precious little bombs were not visible.
As they backed away, Don Bowmore, a brawler from Philly, caught a bullet in the head. He was near Pete, who quickly dropped the sentry and grabbed his pal. Camacho helped him drag Bowmore 100 yards to cover, but he had died instantly. When it was apparent he was dead and couldn't talk, Pete decided to leave his body. The code of the jungle did not allow the dead to be retrieved. Gorillas relied too much on speed. Pete took Bowmore's rifle and handed it to Camacho. From his holster, he grabbed his Colt 45, one he would use for the rest of the war and carry with him back to Mississippi. Within minutes, the guerrillas retreated into the darkness as lights and sirens came on, and hundreds of spooked Japanese soldiers scurried about in a frenzy. Most gathered in the vicinity of the burning car and waited for orders. The dazed officers barked conflicting commands and pointed here and there. The shooting had stopped. The sentries finally convinced the officers that the planes were targeted with something. Patrols were organized to search the planes, but the fireworks began. 5 minutes after setting the loose bombs, Pete ordered his men to halt. They turned and watched. The explosions were not loud, but quite colorful and remarkably efficient. In quick succession, the Zeros began popping as the little bombs erupted and ignited the fuel tanks. Each Zero was consumed in its own fireball, and they burned in the neat rows where they sat. In the glorious glow of the fires, the soldiers could be seen backing away, stunned. Pete savored their handiwork for only a moment, then ordered his men to withdraw, and rapidly. The Japanese would immediately send out search squads, and there was no time to waste gawking. They would not be safe until they were in the bush. Casualties were astonishingly light, but crucial. 3 guerrillas had slight wounds that did not impede their getaway. In addition to Bowmore, a Filipino had been killed by a sentry, and 2 had been shot, could not escape, and were captured. They were quickly rounded up and taken to the jail, where the torture began. At the advance post, a head count revealed 51 survivors. They were giddy with their success and still pumped with adrenaline, but when Pete learned of the 2 wounded left behind, he knew it meant trouble. They would be tortured without mercy. It was never safe to assume a man wouldn't talk under duress. Some were able to withstand incredible pain and never break. Others suffered for as long as they could, then gave up information. Sometimes the information was false, sometimes accurate. Regardless, the men were dead. Pete ordered his men to pack as lightly as possible and hit the trail. He said goodbye to Miller and his men and led D and G troops into the darkness. The first Filipino prisoner was bleeding heavily from a chest wound. The Japanese assessed it and assumed he was dying. They tied him to a table, cut off his clothing, and attached wires to his genitals. When the first current hit, he screamed and begged. Next door, the second Filipino, also strapped to a table, heard his comrade beg for mercy. The first one gave no information. When he was unconscious, he was taken outside and decapitated with a sword. His head was retrieved and taken inside, where an officer placed it on the chest of the second one. The officer explained the obvious. Don't talk, and you'll soon take your secrets to your grave. Wires were tightened around his testicles and penis, and after half an hour, he began talking. The severed head was removed from his chest and placed in a corner. The wires were removed from his genitals, and the prisoner was allowed to sit and drink water. A doctor looked at his shattered fibula and left without treating it. The prisoner gave the name of General Bernard Granger and a bogus location of his base in the mountains. He gave the names of all of the American officers he knew and revealed that Major Pete Banning had led the raid He had no idea who made the small bombs, but they came from someone in Manila. To his knowledge, no further raids were being planned. The doctor was back. He cleaned the wound, wrapped it in a bandage, and gave the prisoner some pills for pain. They helped little. The interrogation lasted through the night. When the prisoner could not answer all the questions, he simply created fiction. The more he talked, the friendlier the Japanese became. At dawn, he was given hot coffee and a bread roll and informed that he would be given special treatment because of his cooperation. When he finished eating, he was dragged to a corner of the parade ground, where his buddy's nude and headless body hung by the feet from a gallows. Not far away, the burned skeletons of 74 Zeros continued to smolder. The prisoner was strung up by his hands and lashed with a bullwhip as a crowd of soldiers laughed and enjoyed the mauling. When he was unconscious, he was left to bake in the sun as the cleanup began. Chapter 34. When news of the Stotzenberg raid reached Australia, General MacArthur was ecstatic. He immediately cabled President Roosevelt and, characteristically, took full credit for an operation he knew nothing about until a week after it was over. He wrote that, "My commandos executed my detailed plan with incredible brazenness and bravery and suffered only minor losses." His guerrilla forces were striking the Japanese in similar raids throughout Luzon, and he was orchestrating all manner of havoc behind enemy lines. The raid embarrassed and infuriated the Japanese, and by the time the men of D and G troops staggered home, exhausted and starving, 4 days after the attack, the skies were buzzing with fresh Zeros. The Japanese had an endless supply, and they intensified their efforts to find Granger. They did not, but their constant strafing at anything that moved in the mountains caused the guerrillas to thicken their camouflage and hunker down even deeper into the jungle. It also hampered their movements. The Japanese stepped up their patrols around the barrios at the lower elevations and brutalized the locals. Food became scarcer, and resentment toward the Americans increased. Never one to sit idly by, Granger began sending squads to ambush Japanese patrols. The highways and convoys were heavily protected and too dangerous to hit. Instead, his men stalked the trails and lay in wait. The attacks were quick and led to fierce gunfights that annihilated the patrols. The Japanese foot soldiers were no match for the well-hidden guerrillas, all of whom were excellent snipers. As the weeks passed and their casualties mounted, the Japanese lost interest in finding Granger and retreated to the valleys where they guarded the highways. Not once did the guerrillas and their intelligence gather information that indicated plans for a full-scale assault on their home base. Granger and his growing forces were safe in the mountains. But the war was happening elsewhere. By the spring of 1943, Japan was in firm control of the South Pacific and threatening Australia. The bridge crossed the Zapote River at the bottom of a steep and forbidding valley. From it, cliffs on both sides rose at such steep angles that crossing them on foot was impossible. The river was narrow but deep and fast, and the Japanese engineers had been unable to build suitable pontoons to ford it. So they built a bridge out of nara trees, which were plentiful and sturdy. Its construction was treacherous, with dozens of Filipino slaves lost in the process. When Granger received orders to destroy it, he sent Majors Banning and Dubose with a squad of 10 to have a look. They hiked 2 days through difficult terrain and finally found a safe ridge to observe from. The bridge was in the distance, deep in the valley, at least a mile away. Using binoculars, they watched it for hours and the convoys never stopped. Occasionally, a single truck or troop carrier went across, and a few sedans with high-ranking officers were spotted. The bridge's importance was evident by the packs of soldiers guarding it. There was a post on each side with dozens of guards milling about, and on top of each hut were mounted machine guns. Below, at the edges of the river, even more Japanese camped around the abutments and killed time. The current was too swift and violent for boats. After dark, the convoys became scarce. By 8 p.m., the bridge was much quieter. The Japanese had learned that their enemy worked best at night, and for this reason, kept their supplies off the roads. An occasional truck, presumably empty, crossed going west to reload. Banning and Dubose agreed that it would be impossible to destroy the bridge with explosives. An assault with men and guns would be suicide. Other than a few grenade launchers, the guerrillas had nothing in the way of artillery. They returned to camp and briefed Granger, who was not surprised. His runners had reported as much. After resting a day, the commanders met with their general under his canopy and over tea debated their options, of which there were precious few. A plan emerged and became the only idea with even a remote chance of success. Most of the convoys were loaded with armaments, food, fuel, and other supplies from several ports along the western shore of Luzon. And from there, they fanned out through the mountains over a grid of highways and bridges the Japanese worked hard to maintain. The first stop for most trucks was a sprawling munitions fort outside the city of Kamaling. There, in endless warehouses, the enemy stored enough supplies to win the war. Once inventoried and safe, the supplies were later shipped throughout Luzon. Kamaling was at the top of every guerrilla wish list, and the Japanese knew it. Even Granger had decided it was unassailable. Truck traffic in and around Kamaling was chaotic. The roads were inadequate, so the Japanese hastily built more. Riffraff always follows the army, and around the city the highways were lined with new truck stops, cafes, bars, flophouses, brothels, and opium dens. What Major Banning needed was an empty cargo truck with a canvas cover, and there were plenty of them parked almost bumper to bumper outside the busy bars and cafes on the main highway into Kamaling. Camacho and Rinaldo wore the matching uniforms of officers of the Imperial Army. Their disguises were detailed, down to the round, wire-rimmed eyeglasses worn by virtually every Jap and hated by every American. The cargo truck they were watching was empty, thus headed west to reload. Its fuel tank was full. After a few beers, the drivers, both privates, left the bar and headed to their truck. They bumped into Camacho and Rinaldo, who suddenly began throwing punches. Fights were common outside the bars. Hell, they were army boys, and bystanders hardly noticed. The fight ended abruptly when Camacho slit both throats and tossed the bodies into the back of the truck where Pete was hiding. With no pity whatsoever, he watched them bleed out as Camacho drove away. On the outskirts of a barrio, they bivouacked with G&M troops and took on 100 pounds of TNT and 20 gallons of gasoline. The guerrillas packed into the truck after flinging the two dead soldiers into a ravine. An hour later, as they began the steep descent into the valley, the truck stopped and the guerrillas got off. A runner led them along a treacherous trail that fell to the Zapote. As the truck approached the bridge and its guard post, Camacho and Rinaldo gripped their weapons and held their breath. After hours of observation, they knew the guards never checked their own trucks. And why should they? Hundreds passed each day and night. In the back, Pete crouched with a finger on the trigger of his machine gun. The guards hardly noticed and waved the truck through. Camacho volunteered because he was fearless and unafraid of water. Rinaldo claimed to be an excellent swimmer. As commander, Pete would never consider sending someone else on such a dangerous mission. The truck stopped in the middle of the bridge. Camacho and Rinaldo shed their weapons, strapped on makeshift life vests, and hustled to the rear of the truck. Pete, who had become proficient with explosives, rigged the detonator and gave the one-word order, jump. They hit the blackness of the cold, raging Zapote and were swept up by the current. In a bend half a mile away, Dubose perched on a rock and waited. His men were in the water, roped together in a human lifeline, ready to fish their comrades out of the river. The explosion was beautiful. A violent shock in the otherwise peaceful moonlit night. A fireball engulfed the truck and the bridge 50 feet in both directions. Panicked guards raced from both sides until they realized they could do nothing. Then they realized a collapse was imminent and retreated to safety. Pete thrashed about in the current and tried to orient himself. The life vest worked well enough, and he stayed afloat. He heard guards yelling and gunshots, but he felt safe in the rushing water. Swimming was impossible, and he tried to steady himself. Several times the current swept him under, but he fought to find air. In one split second, he looked back and caught a glimpse of the burning truck. Near the bend, the current slammed him into boulders he couldn't see, and his left leg splintered. The pain was instant and almost overwhelming, but he managed to get away from the rocks. He soon heard voices and screamed a reply. The current quelled in the bend, and the voices were closer. Someone grabbed him, and he was pulled to the bank. Camacho was already there, but Rinaldo was not. As minutes passed, they watched the fire in the distance. A second explosion tore a gaping hole in the bridge, and the flaming skeleton of the truck dropped into the river. Dubose and Clay linked their arms under Pete's, and they hit the trail. The pain was excruciating and radiated from his toes to his hip. The trauma made him dizzy, and he almost lost consciousness. After a short hike, they stopped, and Dubose administered a shot of morphine. The gorillas had put together many stretchers in the jungle, and they quickly cut two bamboo poles and looped them with blankets. While they worked, the others watched the river for any sign of Rinaldo, but he was never found. For 2 days, Major Banning writhed in agony, but never complained. The morphine helped considerably. Runners alerted Granger, and as the men began their final ascent to home, a medic arrived with even more of the drug, along with a bona fide field stretcher. Fresh troops carried him into camp for a hero's welcome. Granger strutted around like a peacock, hugging his men and promising medals. A doctor set the leg in tight splints and informed Pete that his fighting days were over for a few months. His femur was broken in at least 2 places. His tibia was snapped in 2. His kneecap was cracked. Surgery was needed to reset it all. But that was not possible. Pete was forbidden to move off his cot for 2 weeks and thoroughly enjoyed making demands of Clay. He was instantly bored and began moving about as soon as Clay found a set of crutches. The doctor demanded that he remain stationary, but Pete pulled rank and told him to go to hell. He parked himself each morning under Granger's canopy and became a nuisance. Without being asked, he began advising the general on all aspects of guerrilla warfare and operations, and to shut him up, Granger pulled out the cribbage board. Pete was soon beating him almost daily and demanded payment in U.S. dollars. Granger offered only IOUs. Weeks passed as Pete helped the general plan one raid after another. He watched forlornly as the guerrillas cleaned their weapons, stuffed their backpacks, and set off for their missions. Clay was elevated to the rank of lieutenant and put in command of G Troop. On a damp, misty morning in early June, a runner sprinted to Granger's canopy with the news that Dubose and D Troop had been ambushed as they slept. The Filipino guerrillas had been shot. Dubose and two Americans had been captured before they could commit suicide. They had been beaten severely, then hauled away. Pete hobbled back to his hut, sat on his cot, and wept. By the summer of 1944, American forces were within 300 miles of the Philippines and close enough to bomb the Japanese with B-29s. Warplanes based on U.S. aircraft carriers were hitting Japanese airfields with strikes and sweeps. The guerrillas watched the skies with grim satisfaction. An American invasion was imminent, and MacArthur was demanding more and more intelligence from the jungles. The Japanese were amassing troops and constructing garrisons along the west coast of Luzon, and the situation, at least for the guerrillas, was more dangerous than ever. Not only were they expected to continue their raids and ambushes, they were needed to monitor the enemy's troop movements and strengths. Granger had finally secured a serviceable radio and was in sporadic contact with U.S. headquarters. He was barraged with orders to find the enemy and report daily. Intelligence supplied by the West Luzon Resistance Force became crucial for the American invasion. Granger was forced to split his men into even smaller groups and send them farther afield. Pete's G Troop was reduced to himself, Clay, Camacho, three other Filipinos, and three runners. His wounded leg had healed to the point of being somewhat serviceable, but every step was painful. In camp, he limped about on a cane, but on the trails, he gritted his teeth and, aided with a light walking stick and a dwindling supply of morphine, led his men. They packed even lighter, moved even faster, and used the runners to keep Granger informed. Their patrols went on for days, and they were often without food and sufficient ammunition. Luzon was being fortified with divisions of Japanese infantry, and they were everywhere. Ambushes were avoided because gunfire only attracted enemy forces that could not be overcome. On October 20, 1944, the U.S. 6th Army landed on the shore of Leyte, east of Luzon. Supported by naval and air bombardments, the American and Australian forces overwhelmed the Japanese and continued westward. On January 9, 1945, the 6th Army landed on Luzon, routed the Japanese, and rapidly pushed inland. Granger again changed tactics and enlarged his squads. Once more, they were let loose to ambush the retreating Japs and attack convoys. On January 16th, after a successful raid on a small munitions camp, Pete and G Troop stumbled into the middle of an entire Japanese battalion. They were immediately taking fire from three directions with little room to escape. The Japs were as weary as they were, but they had the advantage of men and weapons. Pete ordered his men to take cover behind some boulders, and from there they fought for their lives. Two of his Filipinos were hit. Mortars began dropping. A hand grenade landed near Camacho and killed him instantly. A shell landed behind Pete, and shrapnel tore into his right leg, the good one. He went down screaming and dropped his rifle. Clay grabbed him, lifted him onto his shoulders, and disappeared into the bush. The others covered them for a moment, then abandoned the fight and backed away. There was only one trail, and where it led no one knew, but they scrambled on. Evidently, the Japs were too tired to pursue, and the gunfire stopped. Pete's leg was bleeding, and Clay was soon covered with blood, but he didn't stop. They came to a creek, crossed it cautiously, and finally collapsed in a thicket. Clay took off his shirt, ripped it into pieces, and wrapped Pete's wounds as tightly as possible. They smoked cigarettes and counted their losses. Four men were gone, including Camacho. Pete would grieve later. He tapped his Colt 45 and reminded Clay that they would not be taken alive. Clay promised him they would not be taken at all. Throughout the afternoon, they took turns shouldering Pete, who insisted on walking with assistance. At dark, they slept near a barrio, one they had never seen before. A local boy pointed one way and then the other. They were far from Granger's base, but the boy thought some Americans were close by, real soldiers, not guerrillas. At dawn, they hiked again and soon came to a road. Hiding in the bush, they watched and waited until they heard trucks. Then they saw them. Beautiful trucks, filled with American soldiers. When Pete saw the stars and stripes waving from the antenna of the lead Jeep, he felt like crying. He walked without aid to the center of the road, his torn fatigues covered with blood, and waited for the Jeep to stop. A colonel got out and came forward. Pete saluted him and announced, "Lieutenant Pete Bannon, of the 26th Cavalry Regiment, U.S. Army, West Point class of 1925. The colonel looked him over. He studied the bedraggled crew around him, unshaven, half-starved, some also wounded, armed with a hodgepodge of weapons, most of which were Japanese. The colonel never saluted. Instead, he stepped forward and bear-hugged Pete. The remnants of G Troop were taken to the port of Dessau, where the 6th Army was still coming ashore. Dozens of landing craft poured fresh soldiers onto the beaches while naval gunboats roamed the coastline. Thousands of Army personnel swamped the port. It was chaos, but one big, beautiful mess of it. The men were rushed to a first aid tent, where they were fed and given hot showers, soap, and razors. They were examined by doctors who were accustomed to treating battle wounds inflicted on healthy young men, not disease-ravaged guerrillas from the jungle. Pete was diagnosed with malaria, amoebic dysentery, and malnutrition. He weighed 137 pounds. Though skinny as he was, he had managed to gain weight during the past 2.5 years. He guessed that he had been 20 pounds lighter when he left O'Donnell. He and three others with wounds were examined by doctors in an adjacent hospital. It was quickly determined that Pete needed surgery to remove shrapnel from his leg, and he was given priority. The hospital was filling up with casualties from the front. Clay and the others were outfitted in crisp new Army fatigues. His new waist size was 28 inches, down 6 from boot camp. They were shown to a tent with cots, told to rest, and given a pass to the cafeteria, where they ate nonstop. The following day, Clay visited his commander in a hospital ward and was relieved to hear that the surgery went well. The doctors could treat wounds, but they did not have the tools to reset Pete's broken bones. That would have to wait until he was stateside. Pete and Clay worried about their comrades back at the home base and said a prayer for Camacho, Rinaldo, Dubose, and the others they had lost. They thought of those still suffering at O'Donnell and the other camps and prayed they would soon be rescued. They also managed to laugh at themselves and their wild adventures in the jungles. Clay returned the next day with the news that he was being given the choice of fighting with the 6th Army or being reassigned to a base in the U.S. Pete insisted he go home, and Clay was inclined to. They had fought enough. 3 days later, Pete said goodbye to his men, most of whom he would never see again. He and Clay embraced and vowed to keep in touch. He and 10 other badly wounded men were gently arranged on a medical pontoon and ferried to a large Army hospital ship. They waited 2 days for it to fill, then cast off and headed home. The ship was staffed with pretty nurses who fed him 4 times a day and treated him like a hero. The sight of their legs and shapely backsides, along with the smell of their perfume, made him long for Liza's embrace. 4 weeks later, the ship sailed into the San Francisco Bay, and Pete remembered the last time he had seen the Golden Gate Bridge. November of 1941, just days before Pearl Harbor. He was transported to Letterman Army Hospital in the Presidio. Like every other soldier on board, all he wanted was a telephone. Chapter 35. The news that Pete Banning was alive was even more shocking than the news that he was dead. Nineveh heard it first because she was in the kitchen when the phone rang. Always reluctant to answer it because she considered it a toy for the white folks, she finally said, "Banning residence." A ghost spoke to her, the ghost of Mr. Banning. When she refused to believe it was Pete, he raised his voice an octave or two and told her to go find his wife and to hurry. Liza was standing outside the barn holding the reins of her horse while Amos repaired a stirrup. Both were startled at the scream from the back porch and ran to see what was wrong with Nineveh. She was on the porch in a fit, jumping up and down, crying, yelling, "It's Mr. Pete! It's Mr. Pete! He's alive! He's alive!" Liza was certain Nineveh had lost her mind, but ran to the phone anyway. When she heard his voice, she nearly fainted, but managed to fall into a kitchen chair. With some effort, Pete convinced her he was indeed alive and resting comfortably in a hospital in San Francisco. He had several wounds, but all his limbs were intact, and he would recover. He wanted her on a train as soon as possible. Liza could hardly say a word at first and tried not to burst into tears. As she regained her senses, she remembered that their conversation was probably not private. Someone was always listening on their rural party line. They agreed that she would scoop up Flory, rush into town, and call Pete on a private line. She sent Amos to fetch Flory while she changed clothes. Agnes Murphy lived a mile up the highway and was known to eavesdrop on every call. The neighbors suspected she had nothing better to do than sit by the phone and snatch it when it rang. Indeed, she had listened to Pete's call, in disbelief, and immediately began calling friends in town. Flory arrived in a rush, and the two women jumped into Liza's Pontiac. Liza hated to drive and was even worse at it than Flory, but at the moment, that didn't matter. The two raced toward town, weaving along the drive and slinging gravel. Both were crying and babbling at the same time. Liza said, "He said he was wounded, but okay. Said he had been captured, but escaped. And that he had been fighting as a guerrilla for the past 3 years." "Good God Almighty," Flory kept saying. "What in the world is a gorilla? I have no idea. I have no idea. I can't believe this. Good God Almighty." They roared to a stop in the street and raced into the home of Shirley Armstrong, Liza's closest friend. She was puttering around the kitchen when Liza and Flory barged in with the news. After a round of crying and hugging, Liza borrowed her phone on a private line and called the hospital in San Francisco. While she waited and waited, she wiped tears and tried to compose herself. Flory made no such effort and sat on the sofa with Shirley, both bawling away. Liza chatted with Pete for 10 minutes, then handed the phone to Flory. She left the house, drove to the school, found Stella in class, pulled her into the hallway, and delivered the unfathomable news. By the time she checked her out of school, the teachers and principal were gathering around the office for another round of hugs and congratulations. Meanwhile, Flory worked the phone. She called the president's office at Vanderbilt and demanded that Joel be located immediately. She called Dexter Bell at the church. She called Nix Gridley at the jail. As the high sheriff, Nix served as the county's unofficial contact point for crucial news. Within an hour of Pete's call, every phone in town was ringing. Liza and Flory returned home and tried to put together a plan. It was late February, and the fields were idle. In the backyard, the Negroes were coming on foot to see if it was true. Liza stood on the rear porch and confirmed the news. Dexter and Jackie Bell arrived first to share in the moment, and they were soon followed by a parade of cars as friends flocked to the Banning home. 2 days later, Flory drove Liza to the train station, where they were met by a farewell party. Liza thanked and hugged them all, then boarded for a 3-day journey to San Francisco. The first surgery lasted for 8 hours as doctors went about the complex job of breaking and resetting most of the bones in Pete's left leg. When they finished, it was encased in a thick plaster cast from hip to ankle, with pins and rods running through it. The leg was elevated to a painful angle and held in place with straps, pulleys, and chains. His right leg was wrapped in gauze and was just as painful. The nurses plied the patient with painkillers, and for 2 days after the surgery, Pete was rarely awake. And that was a blessing. For a month on the hospital ship, he had suffered nightmares and flashbacks and slept little. The horrors of the past 3 years haunted him day and night. A psychiatrist spent time with him and made him talk, but reliving his ordeal only made things worse. The medications only confused him. One moment brought euphoria so extreme he laughed out loud, and the next moment he crashed into utter depression. He slept fitfully during the day and often screamed at night. At Letterman, the nurses eased off the painkillers when they learned his wife would soon arrive. He needed to be as alert as possible. Liza followed a nurse onto the ward and saw two long rows of beds separated by thin curtains. As she walked, she couldn't help but look at the patients, most of them just boys, not too far removed from high school. When the nurse stopped, Liza took a deep breath and pulled back the curtain. Careful not to touch the chains and pulleys and injured legs, she fell onto his chest for a fierce embrace, one that she had never expected. Pete, though, had been dreaming of it for years. She was as gorgeous as ever, dressed to the hilt and smelling of a perfume that he had never forgotten. She kissed him as they whispered and wept and laughed as time stood absolutely still. He rubbed her backside in full view of the nearby patients, and she didn't care. He clutched her to his chest, and all was right in the world. In voices as low as possible, they talked for a long time. Joel, Stella, Flory, the farm, their friends, all the gossip from home. She carried the bulk of the conversation because he had no desire to describe what he had been through. When the doctors arrived on rounds, they gave her a quick summary of the patient's condition and what was to be expected. They anticipated several more surgeries and a long recovery. But with time, he would be as good as new. An orderly brought her a comfortable chair with a pillow and blanket, and she set up camp. She hauled in books and magazines and read and talked and talked. She left his side only after dark to return to her hotel. Before long, Liza knew the names of the other boys and was flirting shamelessly. They perked up when she was around, delighted to have such a lively, beautiful woman showering them with attention. She virtually commandeered the wing. She wrote letters to girlfriends and made phone calls to mothers, always with news that was cheerful and optimistic, regardless of the wounds. She read letters from home, often fighting back tears. She brought in chocolates and candy when she could find them. Pete was one of the luckier ones. He was not paralyzed or disfigured, and all limbs were intact. Some of the boys were pitiful, and they received even more of her attention. Pete was more than happy to share his wife and reveled in her ability to brighten up a hospital ward. She stayed for 2 weeks and left only because Stella was at home with Flory in Nineveh. When she was gone, the ward returned to its gloominess. Every day the patients yelled at Pete and asked when Liza was coming back. She returned in mid-March and brought the family with her. Joel and Stella were on spring break and eager to see their father. For 3 days, they camped around his bed and in general turned the ward upside down. When they were gone, Pete slept for 2 days, aided by sedatives. On May 4th, he was taken by ambulance to the train station and loaded onto an Army hospital ward car for a ride across the country. It stopped many times as men were carried away to other hospitals closer to home. On May 10th, it arrived in Jackson, Mississippi, and Liza, Stella, and Flory were waiting. They followed the ambulance across town to the Foster General Hospital, where Pete spent the next 3 months convalescing. Part 3. The Betrayal. Chapter 36. 2 weeks after his execution, the last will and testament of Pete Banning was probated in the Chancery Court of Ford County. John Wilbanks had prepared the will not long after the trial. It was straightforward and left the bulk of Pete's assets in a trust for Liza, with Wilbanks serving as the trustee or controller. Pete's most valuable asset, his land, had already been deeded to Joel and Stella in equal shares, and this included their fine home. Pete had insisted on a stipulation that Liza be allowed to live in the home for the rest of her life, provided she did not remarry and provided that she was one day released from Whitfield. John had cautioned him that such a clause might be hard to enforce if the children, as owners, for some reason wanted to prevent their mother from living there. The will had other problems, all carefully pointed out by the lawyer and all stubbornly ignored by the client. At the time of his death, Pete owned his farm equipment, vehicles, and bank accounts, from which Liza's name had been removed after her commitment. Before then, the accounts had been held jointly, but Pete did not want her to have access to the money. His personal checking account had a balance of $1,800. His farm account, $5,300. And he had $7,100 in a savings account. A week before his execution, he transferred $2,200 to Flory's account to cover the expenses of Joel's and Stella's education. He also gave her a small metal safe containing just over $6,000 in cash and gold coins, money that could never be traced. He had no loans and no debts, save for the usual ongoing expenses of running the farm. He instructed John Wilbanks to probate his estate as soon as possible and file tax returns. He appointed Flory his executrix and in writing told her to pay the Wilbanks firm whatever was owed and left her a list of other matters to attend to. In 1947, good farmland in Ford County was worth approximately $100 an acre. In broad strokes, Pete left to his children real estate worth around $100,000, including the home. To his wife, he left about one-fourth of that amount, all tied up in a trust, and as John Wilbanks pointed out over and over, all subject to trouble, should Liza decide to challenge the will. Pete was certain that she would not. Upon opening the estate, Wilbanks followed the statutory requirement of posting a notice in the county newspaper on 3 consecutive weeks to alert potential creditors that all claims against the estate must be filed within 90 days. No other information about the estate was given. None was required. Over in Rome, Georgia, Errol McLeish received through the mail his weekly copy of the Ford County Times. He scoured it every week to monitor the news, and he was waiting on the notice to creditors. Soon after the burial, Joel and Stella left the Pink Cottage. It had been a pleasant place to come home to from college, with hot food on the stove.